the debate.
The discovery of remains of 215 children, some as young as three, at a former residential school in Canada, has reopened wounds among the Indigenous survivors of colonial Canadian schools. Yet, when it comes to condemning Canada, condemnations were very far and in between. In this edition of the debate, we will look at the depth of this problem in Canada and why the Indigenous community and First Nation people continue to be discriminated and traumatized even to this day.
The last month discovery of the remains of 215 children at a former Catholic school for Indigenous students in Canada has reopened old wounds and fueled outrage in the country about the lack of information and accountability regarding violations of Indigenous people's rights. On the weekend, thousands of Canadians took to the streets in Toronto to call for greater action from the government of Prime Minister Justin Trudeau on the country's infamous residential school system.
What they need to do is acknowledge that this was a wrong. What Trudeau doesn't want to acknowledge that it was a genocide. But there's actually been five genocides, the fifth one ongoing.
Demonstrators also tore down the statue of Egerton Ryerson, one of the architects of the residential school system at a Toronto university named after him. Following the discovery of the mass grave at a site of Kamloops Indian Residential School in British Columbia, Trudeau said it was a painful reminder of a shameful chapter in Canada's history and urged the Catholic Church to take responsibility for its role in such schools. Pope Francis expressed his pain over the discovery, but stopped short of offering a direct apology.
Seguo con dolore.
I follow with pain the news coming from Canada about the shocking discovery of the remains of 215 children, pupils of the Kamloops Indian Residential School in the province of British Columbia. I join the Canadian bishops and the entire Catholic Church in Canada in expressing my closeness to the Canadian people traumatized by the shocking news. The sad discovery further raises awareness of the pains and sufferings of the past.
Indigenous leaders and school survivors, however, dismissed the Pope's expression of pain, saying the Church needs to do much more. Between the 1870s and 1990s, more than 150,000 Indigenous children were forced to attend boarding schools which were run by churches and aimed to forcibly assimilate Indigenous children into the white Canadian society. The children were separated from their families and barred from speaking Indigenous languages while experienced physical, psychological, and sexual abuse, among other forms of mistreatment. More than 4,000 Indigenous children are known to have died at Canada's residential schools, but efforts continue to find others who never returned home. In 2015, the Truth and Reconciliation Commission of Canada concluded that a country committed, quote, cultural genocide with its decades-long residential school system. Besides, reports suggest thousands of Indigenous women and girls have been murdered or gone missing in the country over the past 30 years. Canada has touted itself as the first country in the world to adopt a multiculturalism policy. It has also depicted itself as an outspoken critic of racism and a leading advocate of human rights. Nonetheless, the discovery of the bodies at a former boarding school and lack of meaningful action on the issue of missing women and girls have raised serious questions about such claims.
Our guest joining us for this edition of the debate, international human rights lawyer Edward Corrigan, joins us from Ontario. We also have lawyer and academic Jonathan Levy joining us from London. Welcome to you both. Edward Corrigan, let me first start with you. I mean, we did cover what happened in this tragic incident, but why don't you give us a quick wrap-up as to what actually occurred?
Well, there was a deliberate policy to assimilate the natives' children. They felt that the adult Indigenous people were not... couldn't be changed, but if they take the children, and the quote was to kill the Indian in the child. So children were ordered and taken from their families and forced to go to these schools. As many as 150,000 children were there, 138 schools, and the conditions were horrific. They were they were cold, they were not proper ventilation. They would put children who were sick with tuberculosis in with the other children. So that at one school, I read that 69% of the children died. And they estimate that around 25% of the children who attended the schools did die, but they don't have proper record keeping. The 215 children's bodies that were found in Kamloops, it's just the tip of the iceberg. There's other schools where they found 15 bodies, and I think if they were to examine, you know, the other schools, 138 schools, they would also find bodies there. They're buried in unmarked graves. They're not properly looked after. The families, in many cases, are not notified of the death of their children. It was just silence. And this is, you know, government policy, government funding, run by the churches, and they were trying to, you know, force them to convert to Christianity. They punished them if they spoke the native language. They even have to speak English or French. And it really was like a penal colony. And you have, you know, horrific treatment. And, of course, it didn't work. You know, the native children didn't have the skills to compete. Yet they were also torn away from their own societies and cultures and couldn't even maybe communicate with their parents because they knew English or French, but the parents did not. They only spoke indigenous language. So it is horrific that how these natives were treated. And it was based upon sort of the aggressive assimilation policy that was employed in the United States by General Ulysses Grant. But yeah, this is a really dark, terrible history, chapter in Canada's history.
It really is, and I'm looking down at some of the things that confirms some of the statements that you made there. And Jonathan Levy, I'd like to find out from you, why were they targeted in such a form and manner? Why, for example, would the church or the residential school system forcibly separate these First Nation children from their families? But in essence, why were they being targeted?
Well, as Mr. Corrigan pointed out, there was a genocidal policy behind it. But in addition, there was already a policy in Canada of contracting with the Catholic Church to provide social services, and the provinces made money. They were paid money by the federal government. In the case of Quebec, 100,000 children went through orphanages and institutions. Some were First Nations people, and some were just simply from disadvantaged families. And the Catholic Church used them for medical experimentation, administered electroshock because they would be paid more money if the children were labeled psychiatric cases. And this went on for 20, 30 years in Quebec. And we're still trying to locate, you know, the mass graves from there. We know where some of them are. The group is called the Duplessis Orphans, and that's a subset of the larger problem in Canada and the terrible problem with the Catholic Church providing social services and everybody making money from it. It was not just genocide, but a corrupt financial bargain between some of the provincial governments and the Catholic Church.
Okay. Again, I'm trying to get to the origins of how this all came about. So you have these First Nation children, and then you have the church, which is supposed to obviously spell religion, come and take them away from their parents and commit some of the most brutal acts that both of our guests here have talked about. Jonathan Levy, you mentioned it, and Edward Corrigan, you also. It doesn't quite make sense as to why a church would do that, why they would do experiments on these children to go to that extreme. And it comes back to my question as to why they were being targeted in this form and manner. Edward Corrigan, can you expand a little bit more for us on that?
Well, it's basically racism. And the English settlers and the French settlers that came here thought that their society was superior to the natives. And the churches thought the same, and they wanted to take the children away from their indigenous beliefs, which were considered pagan, and turn them into Christians. And this was done, you know, in horrific ways through punishment. If the parents didn't release the children, they weren't able to get baby bonuses. And during this period, actually, Indians had no right to vote. If they got, you know, professional skills, they were removed, taken away from, you know, Indian status. They were, these experiments on food. There's a whole pile of different experiments where they would keep a test group and keep them, you know, malnourished, then try to have another group of children that, that would have different, you know, higher and better food. But it was, you know, it's, it, you look at these, it looks like terrible prison conditions of the worst kind. And, you know, the children were all packed in together. And so if one child had tuberculosis or any other diseases, it would spread to all the other children. So, you know, very high numbers of diseases affected the kids. And, of course, many children died because they had inadequate food, inadequate health care, inadequate ventilation. And everything about this was a disaster. And the more numbers they had, the more money they got. But there was not enough money to look after the children properly. And, you know, the federal government provided some money, the province. You know, the province has control over education, but not with regard to the Indians. They were considered wards of the federal government. But they never were properly looked after. So you have these, you know, horrific memories being dragged back because of the discovery of the 215 graves. But there's, you know, probably, you know, 6,000 or more graves like this, and many people, they don't know who is buried there. And there's this, you know, these children just sort of disappeared. People ran away from the schools because they're so horrific, and they were punished severely if that happened. But the families weren't told, in many cases, you know, if their child died, and they were sent away from populated areas to try to minimize the contact between the families and the children in this sort of aggressive assimilation project to turn, you know, the natives into, you know, good little, you know, English-speaking citizens or French-speaking citizens. And, you know, they were, you know, up until, as you know, 1996 was the last school that closed, which was not that long ago. So this period, and, you know, there were periodic reports, and the Truth and Reconciliation report is very, very important. And it, you know, termed that what was treated, how the Indian children were treated and the natives were treated was cultural genocide. So I agree with that. But, you know, this is over, you know, barely 25 years ago, and there was no punishment. You know, they're unmarked graves, and they build over stuff. And, you know, it's when they were putting in a water line, and they uncovered 15 bodies at one school. So there are many, many schools, and people estimate that perhaps as many 25% of the children who attended these schools ended up dying, you know, primarily of disease. But there was sexual abuse, physical abuse, and, you know, social and psychological abuse was all part and parcel of this attempt to assimilate the Indians and natives, right, of indigenous people.
Okay, so we have expanded on that as much as we can, so we have an idea about the horrific experiences that these kids had. But could the possibility, Jonathan Levy, be that this is all about land? We know that Canada asserted control over indigenous people and lands. It was just in 1985 when indigenous people were viewed as citizens, so this is very recent. And I'm just trying to connect the dots here. If it's related in any sense that they are taking the kids away because these lands would eventually be transferred to the kids, but without the kids, then you have the adults that they have to deal with, which at some point they're going to pass away. Of course, then you have restrictions, you have discrimination exercised against them. Is that an outlook or a way to look at this situation?
Sadly, in Canada, there's been a lot of institutional abuse, and finances have also been, you know, the motivation. So, yeah, if you're committing genocide against a people, the idea is you are going to try to diminish them and perhaps take their land, which has always been a problem with the First Nations people. And of course, the entire institutional system with orphans in Canada was based on making money from the federal government. So there was a very strong profit motive involved. And, you know, the people involved should be punished both financially and morally for what they've done. Because, again, some of it was indeed trying to perhaps change the Indians into something they were not. But really, when you look at it, it was genocide. And the idea of genocide is to extinguish people.
Well, what about the Canadian government here, Edward Corrigan? I'm looking at the figure over here that the government had, committed to back in 2019. We can go and check that stat out. $28.1 million was just allocated, was $33.8 million was allocated for this, but you, out of that figure, $27.1 million has yet to be spent. Why is the Canadian president, who in his speeches does talk about the Indigenous people and how they're being victimized, but not doing really much about it, as he's been criticized for?
Well, there was a $1.9 billion compensation fund that was set up by the federal government to compensate Indian Native children who were in the residential school system. They got $10,000 for if they were there for a year or part of a year, and then $3,000 for each additional year. But they had to sign a release that there would not be any other claim of compensation against the government or the churches. They did have some exemptions for, you know, sexual abuse and severe physical abuse, but this was a way of trying to, you know, hide the real extent of the problem and give, you know, what is probably fairly limited compensation for the treatment that these, you know, children received. Now, the Catholic Church has not formally apologized for its treatment. The Anglican Church, the United Church, and the Presbyterian Church have, in fact, apologized. But the Catholic Church, you know, was the largest provider of these schools, you know, in Quebec, across Canada. There's, you know, set over 138 of these schools. And you have, you know, it was sort of a sick system. People were sick. They were put to school, even if they were dying. And, of course, if they have a disease that's contagious, it immediately gets spread to the other students that are in these, you know, close confined quarters. And it's, you know, it is really sad when you're reading about these reports. It just, you can't believe how bad it was. And there were some people who did try to solve the problem. And there was some talk of even getting rid of the reserve system. The reserve system in Canada actually is kind of like a system of apartheid, where the Indians keep on land. And the South African government at one point came up to study the reserve system in Canada to use it as a model for their own system of apartheid in South Africa. And I think that's a shocking revelation. If you think most Canadians would not say, oh, we never had apartheid, we're good, you know, we treat people properly. But unfortunately, it's the opposite of the case. There was really brutal treatment of these children. And, you know, cultural genocide, you know, bordering on, you know, physical genocide. And the orphans were taken away from the children, or even if they had parents, and were put up for adoption. You know, there's 20-plus thousand people were put through the orphan system. And, you know, it's a really sad, sad chapter of Canada's history. Now, hopefully, the federal government will, you know, take responsibility and also put the money in so that they can identify who, in fact, is buried in these unmarked graves and provide some sort of compensation and closure for the families.
Well, right now, the Canadian Prime Minister is actually, Jonathan Levy, criticizing the Catholic Church, aside from what our guest, Eric Corrigan, says about the closure, that responsibility being in the hands of the government. The church is supposed to come out, is supposed to take some responsibility here based on what the Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau has said. And there's been a lot of critique leveled against the Pope that he has not come out with apology really on this, and for the for that institution to take responsibility. Why do you think that is?
Clearly duplicity involved here between both Trudeau and the Pope. The Canadian government can hold the Catholic Church, through their various orders in Canada, responsible if it had the will to do so. So what you're seeing here is the Canadian government can blame the church doesn't apologize, the Canadian government says, well, we can't resolve this because the church isn't cooperating. The church knows where the graves are, where the grave sites are, and they're working behind the scenes, hand in glove, both of them trying to avoid greater liability. The Canadian government has done a settlement with some of the Native peoples, but there is a similar problem with non-Native peoples who were forced into orphanages run by the church for the profit motive. So that's why it's a duplicitous game between Trudeau and the Pope. The Pope is sort of, they're bouncing it off each other, neither one wanting to take responsibility. And indeed, the Catholic Church has escaped liability almost altogether in these matters. And they own vast tracts of land. They have the resources to make a settlement. And they're not accountable to anyone, even though Trudeau could hold them accountable if he wanted to.
Okay, in less than a minute, Edward Corrigan, discrimination against Indigenous people still happens. Is it being addressed properly, or is there a lack of this issue being addressed within Canada? Under a minute.
It's not being addressed properly because you still have, you know, much higher incarceration rates for the Native population. And, you know, you have alcoholism, post-traumatic stress disorder, anxiety disorders, a whole pile of psychiatric disorders, which stem from actually the residential school system, plus, you know, racism against, you know, our Indigenous population. I think one of the reasons why the Catholic Church doesn't want to give a formal apology is that because of legal liability, they're admitting that they're responsible. That would be a strong base upon which to launch lawsuits against the, you know, the Catholic Church and other churches. So the church is concerned about that. They want to limit their legal liability, but I think they should really take responsibility for this horrific period in the treatment of our Indigenous people.
Indeed. Thank you so much. We're going to end with the international human rights lawyer, Edward Corrigan. Thank you for your comments, and lawyer and academic Jonathan Levy there from London. That brings us to an end for this edition of The Debate. So thanks for tuning in. Until next time, I've been Kavitawi.
IRIB English Radio presents Viewpoints.
The presence of different scholars.
And God said, let there be light, and there was light.
The Creator made Adam in his image, then placed the world in his care. May you walk alongside the Creator in righteousness.
God of Abraham, take my child into thy hands, that he may live to thy service.
God has spoken to us before, through Abraham, Noah, Moses, and through Jesus Christ. Why should we be so surprised that God speaks to us now through Muhammad?
Viewpoint, a critique of movies with religious themes on IRIB English Radio.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. A warm welcome to the program Viewpoint on IRIB English Radio with me, Muhammad Javad, hosting this program. This is the movie critique, and this is the second episode that we are dealing with the topic of cloning, especially pertaining to the movie The Sixth Day, directed by Roger Spottiswoode. My dear guest, as always, Sayyid Abdullah and Brother Hussein. Assalamu alaikum to both of you.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullahi wa
barakatuh. Thank you very much. Well, for taking the offer and coming to the studio. Well, in the last episode, we talked about some of the general points about cloning and how this movie, in fact, depicted the concept of cloning. And both of you agreed that this movie, in fact, was not a real depiction of reality. Well,
Or science fiction.
Well, and I remember that you said that if it weren't for Alan Schwarzenegger as one of the main characters in the movie, it couldn't have made it into the box office, right?
Sure that.
All right. We know that this movie, let me start with you, Brother Hussein, this time. This movie takes its name from, in fact, one of the verse, or rather a couple of verses from Genesis, the book of Genesis of the Torah or the Old Testament.
Mm-hmm.
The verses read, God created man in his own image, and behold, it was very good. And the evening and the morning were the sixth day. Well, the movie obviously took its name from the sixth day, the last phrase, all right?
Yeah.
What do you think of it? What do you make of this?
I'm not very sure, but of course, I feel like it has to do with, you know, playing with God's creation, because God is the creator. So the fact that you're going and changing or replicating his creation, which is an extension, his image, really doesn't sit well with, you know, the belief system that we have in place, which, you know, depends on the person, either Christianity or any of the Abrahamic religions. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, that's really what I feel about it.
I see.
Didn't make too much of it, really.
Okay. Sayyid Abdullah, what do you think of the sixth day and its name and those verses of the Old Bible?
Well, like I said, if you remember, like in the last episode, I said there's more to the movie than the actual, like, entertainment idea of it, right? So if you remember in the credits in the beginning, they were, so first they were pushing the article of Dolly the sheep that was cloned. Mm-hmm. And then after that, the same scientists who cloned the sheep, they said, well, it's possible to clone human beings now, since we know the process.
Yes.
And then they said, well, this created two things. It created the law, whether it's allowed or not, and the ethical consideration of this whole thing. So when it comes to the ethical side of things, they said, well, if God, like you said in Genesis 1 to 26, 25 to 26, it says God, whether God's...
It's 27 to 31, are you saying?
124 to 126.
That's fine.
That's what on Genesis, right?
Okay.
So it says God, then he made us on his image, or he made us like him, right?
Mm-hmm.
So they're not, okay, if God could create us and his own image, why can't we create ourselves? Right?
Right.
So they, I think they're more like they're trying to push that agenda where we can create even under the pretext of the Bible, for example.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Or if the Bible allows it, if we created by God on his image, why can't we make more copies for ourselves?
Yes.
And if you remember in the movie, there was this character that was going around killing the clones.
Mm-hmm.
And he says it's an abomination, and he was trying to preserve God's will.
Yes.
And even when you have the people protesting in front of that organization or that lab that was making clones, where people saying, well, this is, you
there's
know,
always protests
God.
Against the atheists.
Yeah, so they're saying this is God. And this is part of the movie where Schwarzenegger himself goes in, right?
Uh-huh.
And then this is where I think it's a bit tricky. Well, that's where it gets. And then he's like, why did you God kill my dog?
Oh, yeah.
Right? He wanted to clone his dog. I'm like, why did you God, if you believe in God, why did he kill my dog? So in a sense, they're trying, I'm not saying they're trying to defy God per se, but nevertheless, they're trying to say, well, we can justify the sixth day, refer to the verse.
Yes.
Right? So I think they were trying to seek justification from a moral perspective, a moral ground that it could be done.
Yes.
Because we have the verse in Genesis 1 to 24, 26.
Thank you very much, Sayyid Abdullah. Let's take a break and we'll be back. Back to the program Viewpoint on IRIB English Radio with me, Muhammad Jawad, hosting this program. And we are talking about the movie The Sixth Day, which is about cloning. Is there anything wrong, basically, what Brother Hussein was suggesting, that, you know, we have it in our belief system, especially in the mainstream kind of or orthodox type of religion or religiosity, that normally these things are not welcome very warmly. These new phenomenon or phenomena which happen as a result of like technological advancement, like something like this, and then it puts sometimes it is embedded in it, like especially based on the philosophy of humanism that puts human in the center of the universe rather than God, right? So they're trying to suggest somehow, one way or another, that man could even replace God by creating.
Yeah.
The, you know, we know that, like, creation and this ability to create, it only belongs to God.
Yeah.
All right? Based on many reasons and, and attributes, divine attributes that they enumerate. But do you think that they have a hint, the movie has a hint, or those people who had an agenda, as you said, behind the movie, had a hint at this, like, concept that, that man could be, like, replacing God?
In my opinion, if you look, like, if you look like at the big picture of this whole movie, right? Just don't concentrate on the effects.
Yes.
The movie, in my opinion, in its nature, is atheistic, right? It has this, because Schwarzenegger himself, he wasn't believing in God, and he made it clear through the movie that he doesn't believe in God, right? But he was having this issue of whether he should clone something or not, right? Should I give it the chance to come back to life or not?
Yes.
So, and since it is, it has this atheist notion to it, so obviously they're trying to push God out of the picture. So when you have this guy himself sitting in an office, and he's got multiple discs, and even when he killed the scientist, he's like, you know what, I could just replace you. He is literally playing God.
Exactly.
Right. So they, since it's not, it's not a religious movie, and it's an atheistic movie, obviously they're trying to create the role or play the role of God and say, well, he's not needed anymore, and we don't need him anymore. That's why you have people protesting outside and, you know, we don't care about what you guys say. You're just noise in the background.
Yes.
But we play God here. God has no role. So they obviously they, that is one of the messages of the movie they're trying to push. But as, like what you mentioned at the beginning, as a human beings, anything, when something new comes in, we find it hard to accept. So we always, I don't know, I think we're immune, or we are against change, I should say. When something change comes, we are against it. There's the big difference between Christianity and other religions and Islam, though. When Islam, when an issue comes along, Islam looks at it from a different perspective. They say, well, is, okay, let's look at it. Is it allowed under the laws of God or not allowed under the laws of God? Before we just fight it off. I say, no, you know, we shouldn't do it. As Christianity does with many things.
Yes.
They close the topic completely. And then later on, like years back, and then they just, you know what? Let's just do it anyway.
Yes.
Like, you remember, if you remember, like, homosexuality back in the 60s, you used to get hanged for it in England. Now the church in England are the one who gets you married to another man.
Yeah.
So it's where Islam says, no, you know what? Let's look at the issue. Is it halal? Is it haram? Is it permissible? Not. Do we have this? Do we have that? And then they give a verdict based on that.
I see. Thank you very much, Sayyid Abdullah. Let's take a break, and we'll be back. Back to the program Viewpoint on IRIB English Radio with me, Muhammad Jawad, hosting this program. And we are talking about the movie The Sixth Day, which is about cloning. My guests were Sayyid Abdullah and Brother Hussein. And let me ask Brother Hussein about this concept of man playing the role of God in a movie.
Yeah.
Do you take it easily, or... you sort of think like what Sayyid Abdullah said.
So, as a Muslim, I do take it as Sayyid Abdullah had said. We Muslims, I feel, are more moderate when it comes to
changes, you know, like this.
Changes like this. We look at the facts. We see if it's justifiable. If it if it can be adopted, you know, into our laws, But if it's not, then we dismiss it, you know, according to reason and facts, not because we are, you know, outraged at the idea without thinking about it.
Mm-hmm.
So I feel the same way as Sayyid Abdullah feels.
I see. Thank
now
you.
I think if I may interrupt,
yes, sure.
Adam,
go ahead.
They said, like in the sixth sense, right, in Genesis 26,
mm-hmm.
I think the word they were trying to get is, and they will be like us, right? That's, I think that's what the word says, and they will be like us.
Mm-hmm.
So I think they might have misinterpreted that word, though.
How so?
When God says they will be like us, not like they will be able to create like us.
Mm-hmm.
They will be creators of their own. They'll be gods. No. Maybe because like in the beginning of the Bible, like if you read like the first verse of the Bible, and you know when God said this, and then he mm-hmm. created man in his image.
Yes.
So they will be like us in the sense that they will look on our image. Not that they are gods themselves. But they were trying to push that fact, the translation of that word. No, when God says they will be like us, meaning he creates, we create. Because mm-hmm. there's a part where the guy says, the scientist, he says, you know what, we created the fish, we created this and this, so a lot of animals went extinct,
mm-hmm.
and they were able to reproduce them through the process of cloning.
Yes.
So he's like, you know, we're playing the role of God here.
Mm.
So I think that's where they misinterpreted that six day
yes.
Quote from Genesis.
Right. Brother Hussein, how about the critical response? You know, we know that the Rotten Tomatoes gave the approval rating of 40%.
Yeah.
In fact, based on reviews from 117 critics. Or we have other critics, for example, from the Chicago Sun-Times that gave 3 stars out of 4 by Roger Ebert, one of the famous critics. All right?
Mm-hmm.
How did you like the movie?
So as I said before, I found it to be very, dull. It didn't have any real effect on me
mm-hmm.
since I am kind of a movie buff. So I've watched a lot of science fiction
mm-hmm.
movies that are, you know, more advanced, I guess, because they're newer. They have a more realistic sense, in terms of scientific credibility. So when I watched this movie, I really had this 1990s feeling to it.
I see.
And, I felt like it was very generic. It was, frankly, boring.
I see.
Like I said before.
Okay, so. Fine.
Yeah.
Thank you very much, Brother Hussein. Thank you very much, Sayyid Abdullah.
Sure.
We were talking about the movie The Sixth Day, which was a 2000 American science fiction action movie directed by Roger Spottiswoode and starring Arnold Schwarzenegger. I hope you like this program. Thank you very much for listening to us. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily round the clock for listeners across the globe. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via internet, shortwave, medium wave, FM, and satellites. Our listeners in Indian subcontinent can listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 41 meters, 7,410 kilohertz, every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to English service of the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave, 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz every day from 1920 to 2020 UTC. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our program via FM 91.5 megahertz. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat, or BAT 5, and via internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program P.O. Box 19395-6767 Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
Around the World with Reporters.
Roughly 1 million doses of the COVID-19 vaccines arrived in South Korea from the United States earlier this week. More Americans have been vaccinated than people in any other country, and the U.S. is now sharing, suggesting no strings are attached, with exceptions and flexibility.
The United States is not asking anything of any country to whom we're giving doses. We're not seeking to extract concessions. We're not extorting. Korea's situation is unique. As the president said when President Moon visited, the animating purpose behind that is actually about the protection of American forces and the forces who serve alongside American forces, the Korean troops who are standing shoulder to shoulder with us in that country.
The World Health Organization and infectious disease experts have criticized wealthy countries for hoarding vaccines, vaccine nationalism, even calling it vaccine apartheid. Experts say the U.S. gift to South Korea had various motives. The U.S. has restricted the use of its vaccine supply for South Korea to Korean soldiers that work alongside the 28,500 U.S. troops stationed in the country. U.S. efforts to contain China accelerated back in 2007 with the creation of the Quadrilateral Security Dialogue involving Japan, Australia, India, and the United States. South Korea has been reluctant to join the grouping as it does not want to offend its main trading partner, China, which has condemned the Quad for targeting Beijing. South Korean President Moon Jae-in secured the vaccines during a summit with U.S. President Joe Biden in late May, as Seoul struggles to balance its alliance with the United States and growing trade with China. Frank Smith, Seoul.
Iranian ambassador to the International Atomic Energy Agency, Kazem Gharibabadi, says it's still not clear whether the U.S. is ready to abandon what he calls an addiction to imposing sanctions on Iran. Addressing the IAEA's Board of Governors, Gharibabadi said Iran is in favor of continuing negotiations aimed at reviving the nuclear deal known as the JCPOA, but that it would only go back to full compliance after the verifiable removal of all U.S. sanctions.
The ball is actually in the court of the United States. They have to take very difficult decisions, and political one, of course, whether they are ready to put aside this policy of addiction to the sanctions or not, and whether they are ready to comply their own commitments under the JCPOA and also the other international obligations.
The Iranian envoy said Tehran is also seeking assurances that the U.S. would not withdraw from the deal again or abuse any mechanism within the JCPOA to reimpose sanctions. On Monday, the Board of Governors heard concerns about Iran's past nuclear activities from Director General Rafael Mariano Grossi. Grossi said there was a lack of progress in talks with Iran about the presence of uranium particles found in undeclared locations in the country. Gharibabadi responded by saying the agency is aggrandizing trivial issues that do not pose any proliferation risk and are not urgent. Instead, he argued, the agency should focus on the nuclear weapons program of Israel that's shunned all arms control and non-proliferation treaties.
I recommended the agency to put aside this political approach and not to convert this organization, not to turn this organization into a political organization. The IAEA should remain technical and professional.
As discussions on Iran come to an end at the IAEA, nuclear negotiators are expected to gather at Vienna's Grand Hotel for another round of talks aimed at reviving the JCPOA. Homolesky, Vienna.
After a raucous first debate, the second presidential showdown was quiet, where candidates focused on laying out their agenda and maintained a respectful tone, even when criticizing each other. With social affairs taking central stage, the debate tested the contenders' capability to address the country's social issues, such as health, education, and poverty.
Currently, there are some 7 million heads of household in our country that depend on charities to make ends meet. We need to set up a fund that ensures a sustainable income for these people.
To fight corruption, we need to fight unfair wealth distribution. We need to pay equal attention to the less privileged stratum of society.
If I am elected president, I will make changes to the circulars that allow astronomical salaries for certain managers. This way, we can help promote justice.
While the three-hour debate focused on social issues, journalists who waited outside the debate studio had other questions to ask, as the candidates got out one by one for a brief Q&A session. I was curious to know how each of the candidates would address regional issues, both politically and economically.
We are seriously pursuing close ties with our neighbors. Our region offers a 500 million strong market to us. But with regards to security issues, I have always stressed that the measures taken by late General Qasem Soleimani have turned Iran into a regional power. We have acted very well in the military field and diplomacy. But what's important is to build a bridge through the military field and diplomacy to expand our economic ties with our neighbors.
As oil-rich Iran is exploring ways to reduce dependence on the fluctuating oil market, this topic was among the FAQs, with journalists asking the candidates about what alternative economic engines they would employ to run the economy.
I will turn Iran into a food hub in the region. To this end, we will need more water and farmlands. We can expand our agricultural cooperation with other countries, especially those in Africa, which has so far been neglected.
To maintain impartiality, the national television, also known as the IRIB, has arranged every step of the debate based on a lottery system, from the order of the candidates' entrance to the IRIB to the questions posed to them, and even their seats, are determined randomly. Candidates will face off for the last time on Saturday in the third debate. This time, the content of what the candidate said might be what the Iranian public remembers from the debate. Now, the seven rivals have one more chance to stand out and woo more public support in the third and final debate, slated for June 12. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
To find a solution to the years-long war on Yemen, an Omani delegation has visited Sana'a and held talks with the leader of Yemen's Ansarullah movement, Abdul Malik al-Houthi, and the head of Yemen's Supreme Political Council. During the talks, Houthi hailed Oman for its efforts and stance beside Yemenis since the beginning of the Saudi war on Yemen.
The Omani delegation is exerting efforts, but its success is possible when the Saudi-led coalition admits it's failed in Yemen. However, it seems Saudi Arabia is still trying to impose pressure on Sana'a by tightening the siege to gain what it has failed to achieve in the war. We appreciate what our Omani brothers are doing and hope that they will succeed in ending the suffering of our people.
Observers say there's good progress in the humanitarian situation and Sana'a Airport might be reopened soon, as well as Hodeidah Port, which means that the fuel ships will be allowed to enter the country. They believe that the success of Oman's delegation will relieve the suffering of millions of Yemenis.
There's a keenness by Sana'a's leadership for the Saudi-led coalition to start taking steps to prove its good intentions to end the aggression. The first of these steps is to complete the humanitarian agreement, open Sana'a's airport and Hodeidah port, and allow the entry of oil ships. After that, other issues will be agreed upon, and this will build trust between the two parties. And the Omani delegation seems to be succeeding in that.
To meet the political leadership and discuss the possible ways to lift the siege imposed on Yemenis by Saudi Arabia. Since the beginning of 2015, the Saudi war has killed thousands of civilians, including women and children, and pushed the war-torn country to the brink of famine.
Yemenis believe that the Omani delegation is finally succeeding in removing all impediments to their access to food and fuel. They say lifting the blockade is the first realistic toward the nationwide ceasefire and the end of the brutal war on their country. Abdul Latif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
Since the turmoil of Brexit, the UK's Conservative government has splurged billions of dollars on expensive military projects, with plans to spend hundreds of billions more to project Britain's military might internationally. But while it's loosened the purse strings of military spending, the British government has tightened them on the country's underfunded public health system and on foreign aid, where it used to lead the way. The $5.5 billion cut will mean less relief for war-torn Yemen, the world's worst humanitarian disaster. The UN Secretary General has called the move a death sentence. The cuts also affect aid to the UN Children's Agency, UNICEF, and other life-saving projects in countries such as Syria, Ethiopia, and Afghanistan. Hundreds of charities, academics, and business leaders have signed a letter warning the government the cuts cast a shadow over the nation's role at the G7 and risk undermining its credibility on the world stage.
The amount of weapons that we are selling to be dropped on the head of the Yemenis on one side, and on the other side denying them any sort of support or cutting down those support, it really is outrageous, unacceptable.
The British government says its decision to slash foreign aid was a response to the economic shock brought on by the pandemic, meaning perhaps that once the health crisis blows over, foreign aid will go back to previous levels. Despite the pandemic, government aid designed to promote the economic development and welfare of developing countries rose to an all-time high last year, with the largest contributions coming from the U.S., followed by Germany. Britain took third place.
There is a fraction within the sort of extreme right who always wanted to cut our contribution to these countries, and they never believed in helping, giving a helping hand. And I think this is an excuse. Right now, it's an excuse to actually give in to those section of the Conservative Party.
Prime Minister Boris Johnson is facing a rebellion at home from MPs, including his predecessor Theresa May, pushing the government to reconsider. Theirs and a growing number of other voices are urging Britain to be the world leader it claims to be. Saeed Puriza, London.
The International Atomic Energy Agency, the IAEA's Board of Governors, convenes a week-long meeting to discuss monitoring and verification in Iran, among other issues. Director General Rafael Mariano Grossi expressed concern over a lack of progress in discussions about the presence of nuclear material in four undeclared locations in Iran.
The Iranian government has reiterated its will to engage and to cooperate and to provide answers, but they haven't done that so far. So I hope this may change, but as we speak, we haven't had any concrete progress on any of the issues.
Iranian ambassador to the IAEA, Kazem Gharibabadi, says he's asked the agency not to use some unimportant issues dating to around two decades ago as an excuse to politicize Iran's case at a time when negotiations are underway to revive the nuclear deal between Iran and world powers, known as the JCPOA. Grossi acknowledged there's nothing that indicates there is a danger when it comes to the safeguards-related issues, but stressed that the agency would not stop asking questions. In his latest report, Grossi also said the agency's access to Iranian nuclear facilities has been restricted since the 23rd of February as a result of a parliamentary law that obliges the government to go ahead with enrichment and other nuclear activities and to deny the agency broader or complementary access beyond the country's regular safeguards obligations. Under a temporary agreement between Tehran and the agency, valid until the 24th of June, the IAEA will continue to collect data at Iran's key nuclear facilities via its surveillance equipment, but will not be able to access that data. Grossi said an extension of that agreement was becoming increasingly difficult. Iran says it will transfer all the collected data to the agency and return to full compliance with the JCPOA after the verifiable removal of all U.S. sanctions. Omar Lizgi, Vienna.
With more than a week left to the upcoming presidential election in Iran, the rivalry gets tighter. After a showdown between the candidates in the first debate, now they continue their campaigns on social media and national television. As the raucous debate revealed little information about the candidates' future plans, reporters try to extract more details through briefing sessions.
If we want to take strides in job creation, we need to pull the plug on sales of raw material. On top of them is crude oil. If one oil barrel gets us $50, its petrochemical products get us an added value of up to $2,000.
The upstream and downstream oil sectors have the potential to generate 880,000 jobs, but unfortunately, 25% of the petrochemical sector is not tapped into. If we operate this unused part, we can save $5 billion in petrochemical imports, and at the same time, we would generate thousands of jobs.
During his two terms as Iran's president, Hassan Rouhani did a lot with regards to foreign policy, clinching the 2015 nuclear deal with world powers, while retaining the country's intimate ties with its eastern partners, namely China and Russia. Now, as the Atomic Accord is facing a bumpy road ahead, most of the candidates believe it's not the master key for fixing Iran's economy.
The removal of sanctions isn't tied to negotiations with the U.S. We can instead neutralize the effect of the sanctions by tapping into myriad of resources in our country, such as rich mineral reserves.
This year, the coronavirus pandemic has curtailed election rallies and electoral tours. Campaigns are conducted through televised debates between candidates, feature documentaries, and speeches. The second and third debates are scheduled for Tuesday and Saturday, respectively, which will be themed with cultural and political issues. Campaigning will continue until 24 hours before Election Day on June 18th.
Well, the first debate was more pugnacious and less informative. It did not give a clear image of each of the candidates' policies. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
After the failure of Moscow talks, an Omani delegation along with the Yemeni negotiating delegation has arrived at Sana'a Airport as part of efforts to find a peaceful solution to the years-long war on Yemen. Mohammed Abdusalam, who headed the Yemeni delegation at the talks, said the meeting was aimed at pushing up the humanitarian situation that has been deteriorating due to the all-out blockade imposed by Saudi Arabia.
The talks are held to discuss the overall situation in Yemen, including the peace talks and the humanitarian crisis in Yemen. Oman has always served as an arena for all Yemenis in political affairs, and today we are going to complete the efforts we made in Oman during the past months.
Observers say this move could make a difference in the political process, as Oman has always been beside Yemenis and realizes the circumstances of Yemen.
The Omani delegation is welcomed in our country because Oman has always been a good neighbor. We hope Oman could help us remove the current humanitarian crisis. We must have this point in mind that if the U.S. continues to link the humanitarian crisis in Yemen to the military realities on the ground, no progress would be made. Therefore, the humanitarian crisis in Yemen should be top on agenda.
The latest round of negotiations in Oman.